song about a bunch of guys and women who are inspired by the Bible. In the 1640s, they were inspired by the Bible to chop off the head of the King of England. In 1649, St. George's Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will.
Welcome, this is Here We Stand. It's Sunday, February 10th. I am your host, Kevin Ann at Eagle Strong Voice. And guess what, folks? It's my birthday today. Thanks to all the loyal listeners who've been wishing me happy celebrations. I was 38 years old. I'm 63 now. 38 years old when this long struggle for me began. And I'm telling you, it's interesting because today we're going to have a number of very heavy topics to talk about, but I want to put it in a certain context first for everybody's sake. 25 years ago, I remember it was my 38th birthday, and I was a happy man in Port Alberni, a clergyman. My two young daughters, Claire and Eleanor, showed up that morning. They were standing next to me. They were 1.5 and 4 years old, and they were standing next to me with presents for Daddy, and it's a glorious memory, and yet that same year, the boot came down on all of us. Fired, blacklisted, separated, lost custody of my kids, although I hate that word, custody. We're not custodians of our children. We're flesh and blood parents, men and women. Anyway, that memory is fraught with pain and sorrow, but let me start with a quote. I want to talk about that to lead into our topic today, but here's a quote from somebody who lived over 2,000 years ago, a philosopher called Marcus Aurelius. He said, if you mourn your own losses and suffering, you're being as foolish as the carpenter who regrets the shavings of wood that fall to the ground as he works. Fate shapes us according to our nature and heaven's design. The gods do not want us to be happy. They want us to grow up. Therefore, in every situation, do what is right and what is in accordance with your own nature, and you will come to know the purpose of your life, and then nothing will defeat you. I love that, man. It's true. And all of us feel at some point in life that we've lost something unrecoverable. I know I did for a long time after I lost my kids and my job and everything that meant something to me. But it's always for a higher purpose. And we have to be persistent so we discover that purpose and not just collapse. Now, you know, it's very popular these days to point outwards all the time to the problem. We always tend to project our shadow. Evil is always coming from somewhere else, just like good is. You know, we live and raised in a slave-based culture. We're, you know, trained to think vicariously, that is, through somebody else, somebody else's ideas. And recovery means to recover our own sense of self and from there the capacity to be responsible. That's the only way we can act because, you know, constantly every day of the week, and this is my purpose now to do this work of exposing these crimes against children, the innocent, building a common law alternative. None of that can happen unless we've recovered some sense of personal responsibility, not looking to somebody else to do it, but say, yes, I can act in my community. I can stop these crimes. This is how I'm starting to do it. This is very important to keep in mind because, as we know from the topic we're going to talk about today, it can seem overwhelming. Now, to remind you, the topic is we're going to be looking more into the details of the Ninth Circle cult in the Vatican, why so-called Pope Francis, Jorge Bergoglio, is about to resign, or at least be forced to the sidelines, his ties to the Dutch royal family and the child-killing network there, and what does it all have to do with Canada? We're going to get into that in a little bit. We're going to have an interview I did with Anne-Marie van Beenburgh. Now, Anne-Marie is a lawyer and politician in the Netherlands who was recruited unbeknownst to herself. She was brought in and blackmailed by being taken to a Ninth Circle cult killing of a child. And she was married to a guy called Kees van Corlaer, who is one of the chief, what's called Drangheta, which is the European mafia, one of their henchmen in the Netherlands. Was married to Anne-Marie, and they used her to recruit other judges and politicians. She's talking from the inside what these Nine Circle cults, the cult rituals, how they operate. And as part of that, of course, in the second part, we're going to look into how it applies to us today, what we can do about it. Now, I want to also flag to you some upcoming shows, which are very important. We have connected with a network in Europe that are doing more than talking about directed energy weapons, targeted individuals, mind-controlling chips. They've documented scientifically how this happens, where it's coming from, and they begin to mount court cases, including a common law court case we're helping them put together. Court cases which actually expose the intelligence agencies and their big money backers that are doing this. And, you know, people always were worried about directed energy weapons. Apparently, according to these particle physicists who I've spoken to and who are going to be on our program in the coming weeks, these targeted energy weapons cannot happen and have effect in the human mind and body unless you're previously microchipped. And this is, there's lots of ways they do that now. There's ways we can scan ourselves to find out if these chips exist. And we're going to go into that in future shows. So in other words, even the most formidable enemy we face, the control of our minds, the scare tactics the establishment uses to make us think we can't do anything, even those things can be surmounted, can be understood, and can be countered. And we're going to get into that in future shows. So I'm going to flag that especially because it's important to prepare ourselves for that when we're hearing these topics, you know, these horrible things having to do with child trafficking, child murder. And today, of course, well, actually tomorrow, one of the reasons we're doing the show is it's the sixth anniversary of the resignation of Mr. Scumbag, Joseph Ratzinger, former Pope Benedict. And on February 11th, 2013, he stepped down from office directly because of the action of our common law court. A little brief background for folks who don't know this, because it was effectively swabbed out of the media and even the alternative media. We had begun a common law court case that had named Joseph Ratzinger, Queen Elizabeth, Stephen Harper, Prime Minister of Canada, 30 people who we call the Dirty 30, involved in genocide and ongoing child trafficking. And that first common law court case in Brussels had named Joseph Ratzinger, Pope Benedict, as a prime defendant. Well, 5 days before he resigned, this was on February 6, 2013, the Spanish government had issued a diplomatic note to the Vatican Secretary of State, Tarcisio Bertone, who also resigned after the fact. And it said that if Ratzinger came to Spain, he'd probably face arrest because of the information the Spanish government and its courts and why a judge called Balthazar had reviewed our evidence and said, yes, definitely, this man is covering up child trafficking. He can be put on trial. 5 days later, Pope Benedict resigns. And he hasn't budged out of the Vatican since then. Now, people say, well, what power do you have? There you go, people. In the wake of that, not only Tarcisio Bertone, but two others, the head of the Jesuits, Adolfo Bishan, and Sean Brady, the Cardinal of Ireland, all stepped down because they'd been named in that indictment. Now, this is a day to celebrate the fact that we would cause that, and the ripple effect it's had over the world is tremendous. The present guy, Jorge Bergoglio, brought in an enormous multi-billion-dollar spin operation to cover up these crimes. Now, that's the effect citizens can have, we the people on the ground can have. There weren't a lot of us who did it, but like we're reminded all the time by Sun Tzu in The Art of War, it's not about your numbers, it's about the threat you pose to an enemy. Attacking what they love, being at the strategic place in time and space, and you can have a power greater than your numbers. So please keep that in mind today. We're celebrating today the takedown of the first and upcoming second pope because of our common law court actions. Also, later in the show, we're going to be talking about updates from the West Coast Common Law Grand Jury, which is investigating how the Ninth Circle cults operate in the West Coast of Canada through something called the 12-Mile Club. That's named after the 12-Mile territorial limit, outside of which they tend to take children who they're raping and torturing and dump their bodies overseas because overboard. In the international waters. That actually is the name they use for themselves. They used to operate out of the Vancouver Club at 915 West Hastings, but now after the light we shone on that during our investigation into genocide in Canada, they've now moved offshore. So you can find some of this at murderbydecree.com. To update you folks, the tribunal, ITCCS Tribunal, itccs.org, is still down. We're being very blocked by HostGator and these other sites which were managing it, giving us a different story every time we talk to them. We're setting up a new system completely outside the existing one to manage our websites. It's taken longer than we expect, but we're working on it. That's what I'm hearing from Europe. They're setting up a new, more secure system. So stand by. That information will be back online. But while you're waiting, murderbydecree.com is the site to go to. And also, finally, before we hear from this interview with Anne-Marie van Bleenberg, to remind you folks that you can find a lot of this stuff, Amazon.com, go to all of our books, the 10 books I've written in the last 3 years, about this, especially two books, Murder by Decree, which is this thing, and murderbydecree.com, and Unrelenting, Between Sodom and Zion. That's telling the story of the last 25 years. In closing, though, I mentioned, 25 years ago when my children woke me up on my birthday when I was 38. The thing that happened that same month, my friend Mark Angus had died. He was a member of my congregation at St. Andrew's United Church. He had helped bring in poor folks and native folks into the pews, helped fill up the church there. He was found dead in his hotel room. And Mark had been talking publicly about the child trafficking he knew was going on through the church networks, through the some of the Aboriginal chiefs, the big money, offshore money coming in to Port Alberni to traffic these children offshore. Mark talked about that, and he was found dead in his hotel room. Now, it is the usual kind of bogus death certificate that we're used to. We know for a fact Mark was murdered, and he even expressed that fear to me the week before he died. Now, when that happened, it triggered something in me, and that led me to do all the actions I did later that year that got me fired, but led me on this onto this purpose. So I'm remembering Mark Angus, my dear brother, today, remembering my children, remember all of the things that we've lost so that many more people can gain and that we can find our real purpose and triumph over all these death-wielding adversaries, as Marcus Aurelius reminded us today. Now, we're going to go to my interview with Anne-Marie van Bienberg. We'll be back after that for more.
Now, my name is Anne-Marie van Bleyenburg. I have been married for 24 years with Kees van Kortlaar. Kees van Kortlaar, together with his three brothers, form a criminal organization known as the Octopus Syndicate. They work from 1960 on till the day of today. In order of Queen Beatrix, they have organized martyr, torture, rape, and killing of children in a public setting. They organized that through youth detention centers in the Netherlands. The youth detention centers were told that the criminals were asking for the Dutch court for children who could work with the Dutch queen for a certain period. The detention centers were very happy. They thought that Queen Beatrix was a very social woman, and they gladly volunteered in giving files of certain children to the criminals. When they wanted to verify what the criminals told them, they were given a name and the phone number of a high-ranking officer at the court of Queen Beatrix, and that high-ranking officer would state and tell them that indeed those criminals were seeking children to work for a certain period at the Dutch court. After receiving files of approximately three children every time, the criminals selected a child that had no relative or family. They told the youth detention center child A is the one we want to see. The youth detention center bought clothes with the child so that it was well closed to go to a solicitation conversation and put the child on train to Zwolle. In Zwolle, the criminals fetched the child from the station, brought it to a building which was equipped as a hotel but was not working as a hotel, although there were people in the lobby doing as if the hotel was in work. The child was put on a table and were giving something to drink, And in that drink, with that drink, the child was drugged. Besides that hotel was a building where the performance should take place. In that building, the people were sat down, and at a certain moment, the child was brought into that building by the criminals, was tortured, raped, and brutally murdered before those people. The audience was around Johan Friso, Prince Johan Friso, the second son of Queen Beatrix. I was told that Johan Friso was quite insane and had an unhealthy interest in young children, and had a steady psychiatrist every day of his life with him. And that psychiatrist's name was Guus Parot Dumont. The criminals organized those killings in accordance with Beatrix. Beatrix paid for it, paid for the killings, and Johan Friso, the criminals asked Johan Friso to bring his relatives or friends with him, and so the whole building was filled with very important people from the Netherlands, ministers, high-ranking officers, and all kinds of people that the criminals could put on photo, so they could blackmail those people and get criminal advantages from that.
Could you name some of the people who were present?
The people that I recognized there were, for instance, Prince Johan Friso, his steady psychiatrist, Guus Parot Dumont. I recognized Mabel Lise Smith. She was there with an old, steady man. I think it was George Soros. I recognized Donner, a former minister of the law department, at this moment Viceroy of the Netherlands. I recognized Ernst Hirsch Balling, a very important former minister of justice. I recognized A. van den Emster. He was for years the head of all judges in the Netherlands. I recognized Dick Berlijn, the former head of the military department in the Netherlands. I recognized a journalist, a very important journalist, Gerlof Leistra, of the journal The Elsevier. I recognized Carla Irades. At present, she is president of the court in Amsterdam, a judge. I recognized Mark Rutte. He is at this moment minister president of the Netherlands. I recognized Geert Wilders. He is at this moment the head of the political party PVV in the Dutch parliament. There were about 50 people every time I was taken there. I have been taken there 3 times. I have seen every time a child was killed, and I have seen 2 boys killed. I have seen 1 girl killed. I presume those children were Netherlands children. I presume those children came from the detention centers of the Netherlands on the way and were recruited on the way that I've told.
You said that officials at the detention centers said that they thought that they had been eaten?
I've asked the journalists about 2005 or 2006. I asked the journalist of the journal The Telegraph to look it out for me and to publish it in the newspaper what was happening. The journalist told me that he had controlled my story with all the youth detention centers in the Netherlands and had spoken to people who had indeed given those files to the criminals and thought that the children they put on the train were going to a solicitation conversation and were going to work for in the court of Queen Beatrix, and that some of those people of the detention center told the journalist that they thought that Queen Beatrix was eating those children up because they were putting them on the train to Zwolle and they never saw them back or heard anything about them anymore.
Do you know what happened to the remains of the children after they died? Do you know where they were buried or what they did with them?
Yes, unfortunately I know, yes. They were first thrown in a container behind the building where they were murdered, a cooling container. After certain performances, the container was brought to Belgium, where they had a piece of land where they put the children in a hole.
Where in, what is the name of the place in Belgium, do you know?
I must look it up.
Okay.
I've found it, but I must look it up.
What is it that you'd like to see happen about all this?
Oh, I want to see those criminals forever after bars.
Yeah. You haven't received any help, though, from within the Netherlands, you said.
Not one thing, and no, it is terrible. From 2004 on till now today, I have spoken with every policeman I could find, spoken with every law official I could find. I've talked to Interpol about this. I've been to court to try to get a conviction of the prosecutor to investigate the matter. The court told me that it wasn't my problem. It was a problem of the society, and the court didn't want to give an order to the prosecutor to investigate. I have done literally everything to clear this up. I have the idea that everything is stopped because Beatrix is involved.
Right.
And the Dutch court is involved. And every time some policeman wants to investigate, they slap him on the shoulders and say, don't do that because Queen Beatrix doesn't want it.
Are you willing to give this testimony in another court, say a common law court?
Yes. I have no objections about that. I'm very, very angry. If you've seen what I've seen, it always stays with you. I can put it aside because it is one of the cruel things that I've seen, but it's horrible.
Yes.
It's really horrible. It is idiot. One time when I was driven back to my home, so my husband took me there. My husband drugged me, and my husband let me see that, and my husband brought me back to the home. And my home was about 100 kilometers far. And during that ride, I suddenly came to my senses. I suddenly discovered that was a child that I had seen killed. I burst out in tears. My husband was driving. He put his arm to me and he said, "Don't bother. They're children of the, a minor order. It's just trash. It doesn't matter that they are killed." It's horrible. It's horrible. I can't describe it. It's horrible. It's idiot that those people who was looking there and not doing anything. Those people are idiots.
And your husband is still alive.
He's still alive and he's still killing people. It's idiot. If you just think how many people since 2004, since I tried to stop it, have been killed. It's 10 years.
Yeah.
They kill approximately perhaps 10 or 20 people a year, if not more. It's horrible. I have shown the police. I have let them see four places in the Netherlands they used as graveyards for people. They liquidated them. Never any policeman has taken the trouble to look.
Can you name those four places?
Yes, I can name those places. I can show them, but I will put them to you by email. But the criminals know that I've told the police. They have had every opportunity to let the bodies disappear again. I know two places where it is difficult for now to let them disappear. One is a pool, but I've seen that they did something there. I don't know what, but it must have been difficult to let the bodies disappear from that pool. But never, normally in the Netherlands, when you find something in a house, a corpse or blood, the police goes with 20, 30 people to investigate it. And when I say to the people, I know four places in the Netherlands they use as a graveyard, and every graveyard, perhaps 20 till 50, perhaps 100 bodies are buried there, and nobody is looking. Nobody is looking at those places. Nobody
right.
goes there.
Could you tell us your name and the date, please, today?
Today is the 5th of June, 2014. And my name is Annemarie van Blijenburg.
Thank you, Annemarie. We'll talk to you again.
That's from an interview, of course, 4.5 years ago. Annemarie van Blijenburg. Now, an update on that. Annemarie is still alive. She's living in a safe house. I won't say where. She has been providing information to our network for a number of years since then, which led to the takedown of some of the Ninth Circle rituals. Now, a bit of background from what she was saying and how this relates to the present Pope, which is a very important thing. The Marc Dutroux was a serial killer put on trial in the 1990s, and in the original police investigation was found that Marc Dutroux had named in his statement Queen Beatrix of Holland as one of the people who was involved in this child-killing network. The remains of 11 children were found in Marc Dutroux's backyard garden, including two young girls, age 8, who had been starved to death after being tortured and raped in his home in a sub-basement area. Now, the police report that was actually eventually issued and the court statement removed any reference to the Dutch royal family. It was just swabbed right out. Later, the judge, Jean-Marc Conneret, who was investigating it, was removed from the case because he was getting too close to the mark. This is from you might want to look it up, the London Telegraph newspaper, March 5th, 2004. The Belgian judge who saved two young girls from Marc Dutroux's pedophile dungeon broke down in the witness box yesterday, alleging high-level murder plots to stop his investigation into a child sex mafia. Jean-Marc Conneret choked in tears on the fourth day of the trial, describing the bulletproof vehicles and armed guards needed to protect him, against underworld figures determined to stop the truth from getting out. Now, he eventually was forced out because he began to ask questions about the royal family's involvement. And this Mark Dutroux was left as the smoking gunman, and any reference to the Dutch royal family was removed. But here's what happened subsequently. The very time when Pope Benedict Joseph Ratzinger stepped down, so did Queen Beatrix. Ratzinger resigned in February 2013, Beatrix in April. That's because Beatrix herself was very involved in Ninth Circle rituals. Ratzinger had been involved as far back as when he was in the Hitler Youth. He had been part of what's called the Knights of Darkness, an NSS cult in some of the concentration camps, child sacrificial cults. Beatrix, because of the close connection to the Dutch royal family with the Nazis during the war, very connected to that. So Ratzinger steps down. 6 weeks later, Beatrix steps down. She abdicates in favor of this guy, Willem Alexander, who's still the present king of the Netherlands. Willem Alexander is married to a woman called Maxime Zoriega, personal friend and alleged lover of the present pope, Jorge Bergoglio, because Maxime Zoriega is Argentine, just like the present pope. Jorge Bergoglio, the present pope, Francis, was good friends with a cabinet minister in the military junta, Jorge Zoriega, Maxime Zoriega, Queen Maxime's father. And they were good buddies with the military junta, trafficking children of political prisoners during the dirty wars in the 1970s and 80s. That's how Bergoglio rose up to eventually become pope. Now, Maxime Zoriega had a shaded past. She had been a prostitute, high-level prostitute in Argentina. And Bergoglio helped clean her record up in order for her to become queen of the Netherlands. Well, what's interesting is the reason this Willem Alexander and his wife, Queen Zoriega, took over is because the heir to the throne, who Anne-Marie van Beenburg had just mentioned, this Prince Frigio, who was present at these killings, he died of a sudden skiing accident. Now, of course, this is what the elite use when they knock off their own. They use the term skiing accident. Pierre Trudeau's eldest son was killed in a so-called skiing accident. He and Justin Trudeau, the present Prime Minister of Canada, another Manchurian candidate programmed clone, killed in a skiing accident. Now, Frigio died in hospital 12th August 2013 after Ratzinger had resigned. And right 2 weeks before Cardinal Bertone resigned, so you see, the one who'd been named under indictment, they did a cleaning of shop. They got make sure Ratzinger and Queen Beatrix stepped down. Frigio was killed. Bertone resigned. These are all the top people in the Vatican and the Dutch royal family involved in this stuff. Now, what was really interesting, here it gets even more ridiculous. Prince Frigio, who died suddenly, was married to a woman, Mabel This Smit, S-M-I-T, and one of the people who was at this ceremony that Anne-Marie saw was named De Smit. It was her uncle, actually. Mabel De Smit worked for, guess who, George Soros at the Open Society Institute. She was also a girlfriend of one of the top mafia heads in Holland, a guy called Klaus Brunsma. So here, Prince Frigio is married to the mob, married to Drangheta, who's bringing these kids to these ritual killings, working for George Soros, who was named at one of these nine-cycle killings that Anne-Marie described in this interview we just did, along with Mark Rutte, the president of the Netherlands, the other people she mentioned in the interview. And so clearly they did a house cleaning. This is why Bergoglio came in. But the present guy, Jorge Bergoglio, Pope Francis, is directly tied to these killings through Maxime Zoriega and the Dutch royal family. They are close buddies, probable lovers. And this is the reason why they're forcing Bergoglio out now, because once again, as with Ratzinger, the light is getting too close to this Ninth Circle connection with the Dutch royal families, the Vatican, and Drangheta, the European mafia. Now, to bring it closer to home, of course, this isn't confined to Belgium and the Netherlands, it's just older and more entrenched there. Very strong connection with Canada, because during the war, World War II, the Dutch royal family was brought over ostensibly to get away from the Nazi invasion of Holland. But in fact, the Dutch royal family were important in bringing over Nazis after the war to Canada. Canada had more Nazis brought in than any other country after World War II because they were channeled through Project Paperclip down to the U.S., given fake identities, and often stationed in Indian hospitals, the Allen Memorial Institute, where they're doing mind control research with CIA money. All of this has been well documented through Project Paperclip. Well, the Dutch royal family were involved in that big time. In fact, when we were doing the dig at the Brantford Indian Residential School, we had eyewitnesses there describing not only the presence of Dutch-speaking and German-speaking high officials where children went missing, but we even found documents showing that the Canadian Parliament had granted complete immunity from prosecution to the Dutch royal family while they were living in Canada. So they couldn't be prosecuted for anything. Very interesting. So the Canada-Dutch connection is very strong. In fact, the Canadian government brought in a special immigration law after the war encouraging Dutch people to immigrate to Canada. I often mention to people doing ministry in the prairies, every second family there was a Dutch woman because they came over and married a lot of folks after the war. Well, this went to the high levels as well. And this 12 circle, 9 circle slash 12 mile club network was rooted in Canada early on. We know from the Brantford Residential School, eyewitnesses describing cult ritual killings there. One of the reasons this story was completely swabbed out of the media in Canada when we surfaced it in 2011, 2012. But the thing to keep in mind, though, is that it's carrying on today. The 12 Mile Club, as we described, and this goes into more that we're going to go into in coming shows, the 12 Mile Club is operating directly with these elite connections. The Archbishop of Vancouver, the Catholic Church, Raymond Roussan, who was actually the guy that was running the place when we occupied Holy Rosary Cathedral as part of our actions that forced the Canadian government apology in 2007-2008. Roussan resigned of a so-called nervous breakdown soon after we occupied his church. In fact, he was removed to get out of the limelight because he and this guy, Cardinal Marc Ouellette, who's still in power, he's number three man in the Vatican, Cardinal from Quebec, they're very involved in this 12 Mile Club, from our witness testimony. This extends, of course, to Cornwall, Ontario. The networks across Canada are quite obvious, and the reason it's all out in the open and easy to document is because these elites feel they don't have anything to worry about, because for many years the RCMP has been doing a lot of work to cover these things up. Now, my piece of this is I began to discover this through working with Indian Residential School eyewitnesses, and it was one of the reasons my friend Mark Angus was killed when he was, because he found out one of these links, that in fact the offshore child trafficking was going on right through the Alberni United Church Indian Residential School. Eyewitnesses describing cult killings at that school. You're going to hear in a clip in a minute me reading from my book Unrelenting, where I describe more of this in more detail. But this was all part of this, you know, different heads of the octopus. And it's clear that Canada has been used for many generations as a cover for a lot of this. You know, ad nauseum, you always hear how nice Canadians are. That whole image is like the local child rapist who has the sterling reputation. Canada's been used as a cover for not only experimental programs, but these satanic networks operate quite clearly in a number of places. Now, on my own, it didn't take a lot of work to find out about this. Where is the media? Where are academics? Where are so-called activists? Alternative media? None of them will touch the story. And that leads on to another question, which we're going to talk about in future shows, which is overt mind control, the chipping, the taking down of anyone who starts looking into this. Now, I'm an exception, and we're going to talk about why that is, why I've come to a conclusion about why me and a few people around me are not touched by this, apparently. But it clearly, you know, it's time and again my experience that people will show initial interest in this, and then bang, they're taken out, like their brainwaves are modulated to drop out of sight. And not only that, I mean, normally if somebody disagrees with you, they'll come back to you, you know, a month or two later saying, yeah, somebody pressured me, I'm sorry I did that, or you hear scuttlebutt, but this is a complete turnoff. Like their brains are shut off like a light bulb, and like they've never heard of me, they've never seen any of this. That's overt kind of interference going on. And don't forget, the reason these experiments went on in Indian hospitals and residential schools in Canada was they had to perfect these mind control techniques, and they did it early on in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, using these Nazi doctors and all these connections we're talking about. So you see, we're putting together a much bigger puzzle with all these pieces now. They're beginning to fall into place in a big way, and it's about how our minds are continually controlled and how we can break free of that. We're going to be talking about that in future shows. how to detect these processes and fight them and expose them. And don't forget, our experience in Canada is when you shine a light on these criminals, doesn't matter how powerful they are, they run for cover. They're cowards. They do not, they're actually much more afraid than we are when you confront them as people. And we've done that, and we know in practice that works. So people, do not be afraid, do not be intimidated by this stuff. It's part of our awakening and our taking back our children, taking back our world, the law, everything. But we have to take back our own minds first. Now, I'm going to go into our last message here. This is a reading I did from Unrelenting, which goes into more details of what I've been talking about. We're going to hear that. I'll have a summing up and more announcements after. But this is from, actually, if you guys have a copy of my book, you can get it on Amazon. It's Unrelenting Between Sodom and Zion. Go to chapter 6. I go into this, page 278, in more detail. But other readings from here that you'll be hearing over the next bit. So enjoy this. We'll be back after this this clip.
Hello again. It's Kevin Annett. I'm reading another excerpt from my upcoming book, Unrelenting. This is from chapter 2, entitled The Malefactor. It began in small places we'll never see, like any incubating virus. Hidden and deadly, it formed itself into official pronouncement, papal statute, joint stock companies, and eventually ships and their crews. Armed with Roman law and European canons, it struck outwards to subjugate and seize the entire world. It killed mercilessly, and then it spoke of healing. We know the official accounts of this plague, having been carefully inoculated to it, and thus incapable of shrinking from its horror. It's all in the past. Things are so very different now. I was raised in the culture it spawned and that spawned it. As a boy, I sat quietly through our well-ordered church services and learned how God favors certain people and not others, how God tossed our forebearers into earthly suffering because they had disobeyed him. I learned to become permanently confused by loving a deity who'd even had his own dearest child betrayed and flogged and ripped to pieces on a cross. Soon I lost something that had been born within me, that was more than innocence, more like a nebulous presence that was everything, a breath that some lingering indigenous people envision as an animal spirit who accompanies us and links us to all of creation. My animus was bound in chains as if I became part of the plague, and I could imagine nothing but it. But somehow, years later, my time did come as a man, and my submerged spirit drifted out from its captivity so that I could finally understand the thing in which I had been raised, and that was responsible for the massacre of so many and so much. And being finally free, that spirit changed everything. The story of what we call genocide in Canada has been told, in part, but it has never been understood, because it's just a word. A life is very much the same. We can describe it, but we can never understand it. It is beyond understanding. I've spoken about the plague and what it did many times, but when my mouth opens to explain it, why it happened and what it actually is, another voice speaks instead, one that fogs more than it reveals. We're all like that. We're all children of the thing that we describe but never comprehend. I met this quandary the morning I handed a photocopied document to my fellow graduate students soon after my expulsion as a minister from the United Church. The page that I handed them was a report by a Dr. Peter Bryce that showed that half of the Indian children had died in the gulags we still call residential schools. The scholars looked at this document. They seemed briefly alarmed by it, and then they turned away from the mirror I had held up to them. It went on like that for many years, once I had become an exile to myself and my own people, and eventually even to the plague. I kept speaking to a barricade of backs, but truth slips past all of our arrangements, for it desires only to find a fertile nest in which to grow. And it did, even as the plague swept on. All of it changed me, just like it did Canada and Rome. As opaque and unmoving as the arrangement appears, it must respond to a continual challenge, no matter how small. The thing adapts to each one of our assaults, but it is capable of dying. I stood next to myself outside the Vatican one October morning in 2009, and a new voice in me told an entity to leave that place. The next day a tornado followed my words, and thus did I begin to understand. The plague came from us, not as an alien intruder from the outside. It moves and lives so easily among us and takes up residence again even after we have exposed and expelled it, because it is us. Only when I understood that could I do more than protest and expose it. I'm not a praying man, because I find I'm just talking to myself. Anyway, why does eternity require any sort of dialogue between me and itself? But I do know the power that has acted through me and dislodged the arrangement, a power that's just as much a part of me as the plague. That said, I sometimes feel that I was the problem all along. I never understood why so very few people were ever really bothered by the abomination that I revealed. My illusions crumble slowly. Still to this moment, I grow angry and weary when the world ignores what I am uncovering and what I am attempting, as if humanity should be anything other than what it is. My father said that the only problem with idealists like me is that we can't relate to most of the human race. Nor should you, he always adds with a smile.
Thank you. Thank you. More to come.
Well, that's a reading I did a little while ago from my book, Unrelenting, Between Sodom and Zion. Now, I want to, with the last 5 minutes here, I want to just make a remark, which I hope resonates with you. And that is that this evil we're describing doesn't come from anywhere other than ourselves. The shadow and the light is within all of us. And I'm not saying that as a way to psychoanalyze the situation out of existence. I'm not saying this to take away responsibility from the real criminals. But these criminals are put in power by us. They're put in power by our indifference, by our votes, by our tax money. And I think mostly by just our feeling that we can live our life for ourselves and nobody else. Proof of this, we're not bothered by this evidence. We're not fundamentally bothered. We don't act. Had there been even a dozen people in the streets of Canada or America or any other country demanding that these child killings stop, we put out a call and we're lucky to get five people. Thousands will show up over acceptable issues, about the environment, about so-called political issues, whatever. But doesn't it strike you odd that nobody's concerned about the most basic thing we are as human beings, our children, the survival of our species, the next generation? That doesn't elicit anything but fear and apathy or anger. What does that tell you? Just look at that for a minute. Our most basic instinct of self-preservation and their caring for our young is being swabbed right out of us. Now, that's not normal. You know, I remember this incident from years ago. I'm sitting on the stairs with my daughter, Claire, and we're watching these barn swallows above us. They built this nest. And the little baby barn swallows have just been born. They're kind of hanging on the edge of the nest, and Claire is all happy watching the birds. And suddenly this crow shows up, and of course crows love to eat other baby birds, so it starts diving towards the nest trying to grab one of these newborn barn swallows. Suddenly, not only the mother, but about 5 or 10 other barn swallows show up from nowhere. These are other birds, not the parents, not the mother of this barn swallow, but other birds. They show up and they start attacking this crow to drive it away from the nest, bombing this thing, and eventually it flies off. And Claire and I were so happy. I told Claire what she saw what happened, but she was just, there was something in her that lit up when she saw, as in me, the fact that, yes, we care and we will die for our young. Well, that isn't happening, people. There's something fundamentally sick and wrong with all of us. Stop looking elsewhere to the problem. Stop looking to George Soros or anyone in power. Stop looking to people in authority, whether it's Mr. Trump, whether it's Mr. Putin, whether it's anybody else in authority. Those guys get there through crime, criminality, and big money. They're the oligarchs who are running the world, and they've got blood all over their hands. And we've got to stop looking vicariously to somebody who happens to agree with our politics as our salvation. When we do that, we contribute to the torture and murder of those children. And don't believe for a minute that everyone in power doesn't do it. Don't believe that anyone in power is somehow kind of working against the system. That's our wishful thinking. That's our vicarious thinking. Now, what vicarious means in Latin, vicari, is to substitute for someone else. That's why the Pope calls himself Vicari Christi. That means the one who replaces Christ. He's the Antichrist. He's an opposite to Christ to fool us, to distract from the Christ within us, which is the source of our power. That's one name for it. Vicariously, we're always looking to somebody else because we don't believe we can do it ourselves. Frederick Douglass, the slave who liberated himself and started the abolitionist movement in America, he said, when you're a slave, you've lost the capacity for moral responsibility. You're looking to somebody else to do everything all the time. Even if it means the loss of your children, even if it means you know children are being killed down the street, you still won't act. Well, we need a fundamental recovery of ourselves. So I say to all of you out there, do not bother getting involved in this work. Don't even bother tuning back in here. If you're not willing to take moral responsibility for yourself and find that hidden thing in you that perhaps has been killed, that empathy. Tonight, tomorrow, children are going to be tortured and killed. And if you don't do anything about it, you are responsible. It's that simple. You don't have to be a saint. You just have to be a human being. So, on that note, I want to invite you to use this as springboard. The shock and the loss we face are actually the ways we wake up. Remember what Marcus Aurelius said earlier. God doesn't want us to be happy. God wants us to grow up, become fully mature and responsible people, which we're not at the moment. So, people, on that note, I thank you for tuning in. We're going to end with a song which has obscenities in it, but really good. It's the Fuck the Pope song by Tim Minchin. And I'm sending this out especially for Mary Kelly, my sister in Dublin, Ireland, 78-year-old woman, fantastic woman, led one-woman occupations of pro-cathedral in Dublin, demanding that the archbishop be arrested. She just walks in there with her T-shirt and walks around to arrest the archbishop, right? Where are the children buried? I love her. Mary Kelly, this is for you, because when I came to Dublin last night, I played the song for you. You were singing it all day. You were singing it in churches. It's a great song. It sums up really what I think our attitude has to be. So on that note, again, follow our work, murderbydecree.com. If you think I'm full of shit, if you think you want to get on board with this, recover yourself, folks, and write to me, thecommonland@gmail.com. As Oliver Cromwell said, these matters are too serious for good manners. I love it. Until next week, stay strong, stay clear. We'll be back. I thank you.
All right, this is the last thing you're going to hear tonight. It's a happy song, but it's got its complicated words, so just listen really hard. Fuck the motherfucker, fuck the motherfucker, fuck the motherfucker, he's a fucking motherfucker. Fuck the motherfucker, fuck the motherfucker, fuck the motherfucker, he's a total motherfucker. Fuck the motherfucker, fuck the motherfucker, fuck the motherfucker, fuck him, fuck the motherfucker, fuck the motherfucker.